Connie and I had many friends scattered around the neighborhood. At least Connie did. I always let her make the initial moves, then I would just tag along. Our most consistent friends were Joan and Betty Mae Bird, our doll-playing companions. We also swam with them at Heath Landing in the summer holidays. One day, their whole family was in a severe car accident on the Gorge Bridge. Joan and Betty Mae were in hospital for some time, then stayed with relatives until their mother was well enough to come home. They told us their mother broke every bone in her body. I found this idea intriguing and couldn't wait to see her when she finally came home. Disappointingly, she looked the same as always. Then there was Muriel Pierce. We didn't count her as a friend, really perhaps because she didn't seem to know how to play. But she was around from time to time. Muriel was a bit older than Connie. She had curiously pale, flaky skin, eyes that were almost colorless, and never seemed to look directly at you, and a tawny frizz of hair held back by the kind of barrette I longed for. But barrettes were common, and I was stuck with my draggled hair ribbons. Muriel sometimes wore clothes her mother had sewn for her by hand, with big, uneven stitches showing in the seams. Once, however, she showed up in a wonderful bias plaid circle skirt from the Eaton's catalog. And this I did truly crave, common or not. This was at a time when Connie and I were wearing hand-me-down private school tunics of scratchy navy blue serge with box pleats and sash. Muriel lived with her mother at the top of Parkview Hill. We were shown pictures of her father, handsome in his officer's uniform. He had died a hero in the Great War. But if this were so, wouldn't Muriel have been a lot older than she obviously was? Their house was small and dark and incredibly untidy, things piled on top of every available flat surface. Mrs. Pierce was a large, sallow-faced woman with lank, dark hair drooping over her ears. She always had a hand-rolled cigarette sticking to her lip, the ash falling where it might. This was especially distressing when she leaned over the cooking pot to stir the stew. She had a liking for discussing her most personal problems of feminine hygiene, a habit I found fascinating, even as it disgusted me. Mrs. Pierce had been trained as a nurse, and in order to supplement her income, she took in a boarder who needed nursing care. This was Henry Brand, who was connected to my mother's family. It seems the Brand children had been orphaned when their parents died in a train crash. Since Mum's parents had been good friends of the elder Brands, they took the children in to bring up along with their own family. All the Brands had brilliant minds, including Henry, but Henry suffered from a strange malady that Mum called sleeping sickness. This meant that he would go into dreadful spasms without any warning. Nowadays, this would have been controlled by drugs, I imagine. Henry was still quite a young man, and I sort of liked him. Possibly because he always had sticky, gritty candies in his pocket. He walked with a curious, hopping gait. He would come lurching down the hill to have tea with Mum. He would be sitting at the table, full teacup in hand, in the middle of an animated conversation, when suddenly his whole body would go into spasm, and he would be shaking violently from head to toe, emitting a dreadful gagging noise. He would shudder rhythmically from side to side, tilting ever more dangerously toward the floor, teacup rattling in his outstretched hand. We would watch, mesmerized, as he leaned closer and closer to the floor. Suddenly, he would recover, sit upright again, and resume the sentence that he had been interrupted in, taking a sip of his tea. Mum would sit through this impassive, as if she didn't notice our gaping mouths. I'm sorry to say Frank became quite adept at imitating Henry, to the great mirth of the rest of us. When I was 8 or 9, the barbecue was built on the Gorge Road, only a vacant corner lot away from our house. This was an early forerunner of the White Spot style of eatery. Customers would park outside, blink their lights for service, and eat their hamburgers and milkshakes in their cars, while listening to greatly amplified jukebox music. We fell asleep nightly to the strains of String of Pearls and Cheerabirabin. We loved it, but Mom started her campaign to persuade Dad to move house. The barbecue was run by the Suttons, who had a son my age called Morley. Morley used to play cars with Chris in the sandy space by the road that Chris had transformed into an ever-changing network of roads, tunnels, overpasses, and bridges for his collection of dinky toys. I liked to play Tarzan with Morley. I was allowed to be Jane while Morley swung from branch to branch of the old chestnut tree opposite his house. Morley would pound his chest and yodel most convincingly. He had seen the movie. I always loved that chestnut tree. It was lovely in May with its scented white candles. Then throughout the summer, as the sticky green fruits developed, only to gift us in the fall with shiny conkers. Since we were close in age, Morley was thought to be my special friend, but in actuality, he was Connie's slave. He was a stodgy, agreeable child, a bit on the gullible side, and Connie relished getting him to do whatever she wanted. Connie was always full of inventive schemes. She read that you could make a telephone from two soup cans and a length of string. We tried this, threading a ball of string from our bedroom across the road and over the vacant lot and up to Morley's window. The telephone did not work, but since the string was already in place, Connie had to try another communicative device she'd heard about. She would tie one end of the string to her big toe at bedtime. Morley would do the same at his end, and she would be able to signal him with a jerk of her foot, which would send a jerk across the wire to waken Morley. This would be used to summon Morley to a midnight feast, something Connie was determined to try. Well, we made all our plans, scavenged some food for our feast, and agreed that Connie would waken Morley at midnight. She overslept, but did manage to wake up around 5 a.m. When there was no response from Morley's end of the string, she decided to go ahead anyhow. She roused me, we dressed silently and crept down the stairs, shoes in hand, avoiding the noisy treads in just the way we'd read about. We made our way to Morley's through the pearly dawn, shivering with cold and excitement. Pebbles thrown in his window pane eventually roused Morley, who finally appeared at his back door, drowsy and disheveled. Where to have our feast? Well, the obvious, most dangerous place, in the middle of Gorge Road. There was no traffic at that hour, so we were able to huddle on the yellow line, shuddering, thrilled by the daring of it all. I don't remember what we ate for our feast. That wasn't important. The big thing was that we were out in almost the middle of the night on forbidden territory. An early driver honked at us, and we beat a hasty retreat. As we crossed the road, we saw a long, fat garter snake zigzagging across the asphalt. Morley picked up a stone and threw it at the snake. Soon we were all three pelting the poor creature, which flung itself around in ever more erratic lunges. Finally, the unthinkable occurred. The belly of the snake seemed to split open, and out emerged scores of tiny, wriggling snakelets. What had we done? Suddenly, it was time to go home. Without a word, we crept shamefacedly away, heading back to our warm beds. We never spoke of that snake again. Sometime after this, the Ferrance lot was subdivided, and a new, small house was built next to us, where they used to have a tennis court. Connie and I supervised the building of this house. Sometimes a kindly carpenter would be persuaded to make a long purl for us out of wood shavings. But it was best when the workers were not around. Then we would sneak into the place and furnish it with our imaginations. Connie had maroon damask draperies over Venetian blinds. There was a matching three-piece Chesterfield suite, also a maroon, and a room-sized carpet. That bedroom had the latest in mahogany bedroom suites, complete with elegant vanity, as featured in the Eaton's catalog. Once we decorated it to our specifications, we had to people it with our families. Connie was married to a tall, dark, and handsome playboy millionaire, who plied her with orchid corsages to pin on her slinky, bias-cut evening dress, cleverly draped to emphasize her curves, worn, of course, with her mink stole. My imaginings were far less exotic. All I could come up with was a daughter named Poppy, who, like Honeysuckle, was disadvantaged in that she couldn't speak. She made up for it with her mischievous tricks and sunny personality that made all who knew her love her. The new house was furnished, and the Allens moved in. They did not decorate as nicely as we would have done. Gordy Allen was Connie's age, a wiry, much freckled redhead. He liked best to play cops and robbers in the top field, a game where girls were not allowed. It was essential to keep on Gordy's good side, because otherwise we would not have managed to listen to the radio serial, I Love a Mystery. This 15-minute program came on every weekday just before supper. We were not allowed to listen to it at home because Mum felt it was violent and unedifying. But it was such fun to follow the absurd plots day by day. Somehow, we always managed to need to go over to Gord's just in time to catch the latest installment. I don't know whether Mum guessed what we were up to or not. One radio serial we were allowed to listen to was Little Orphan Annie, this being much more suitable for our ears, if boring. The thing about this program was that you could join the Little Orphan Annie Radio Club. If you sent two labels from Ovaltine, the program's sponsor, you could become a member. You would receive Annie's secret decoding badge, and with this, you could send messages to your friends who are also members and decode the secret messages, which were sent on every program. Several kids in my class already had these badges, and I was desperate to have one too. The problem was getting the labels. I persuaded Mum to buy a tin of Ovaltine, but no one liked the stuff, and it was a very large tin, so there seemed no way to get the second label. Connie took over. We'd get the label from someone else, Morley. Morley, however, was not likely to want to drink Ovaltine when he had access to as many chocolate milkshakes as he wanted from the kitchen of the barbecue. Connie was not stumped. At this time, Ovaltine's magazine ads took the form of a comic strip, telling the story of a mother at her wit's end because her child was so puny and frail, learning from a kindly neighbor how Ovaltine at bedtime would cure all his problems. The final frame showed a healthy, hearty child and a relieved mother. And we owe it all to Ovaltine. The idea, Connie figured, was to get Morley to pretend to be pining away, at which point she would kindly suggest to Mrs. Sutton that Ovaltine might do the trick. Now, Morley's acting ability was not too marked, and it would be difficult to make him look the part. He was so round and pink. But it was worth a try. Connie coached him thoroughly in how to act languid and peevish, how to appear to lack appetite, how to be snappish and ill-tempered. Given Morley's disposition, this seems like an inappropriate feat, but we were desperate. We needed that Ovaltine label. Morley obligingly whined a little, refused a second hamburger, asked to go to bed early. Connie showed up with her spiel. Ovaltine, snorted Mrs. Sutton. I never did get my Little Orphan Annie secret decoding badge.